and welcome to Season 3, Episode 18 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, professor and filmmaker Jonathan Vincent joins us to discuss art and beauty. In part one of our conversation, Jonathan suggests a Christological foundation for his understanding of beauty, and we wrestle with the question of whether the horror genre can be beautiful.
Well, what's a highlight for you this week?
Highlight for me this week is that one of our teammates came back from the U.S. He was there for 4 months. Well, except for when we happened to all be at a conference in Mexico in the middle of it, which is totally random. But so we're all back now as a full team for the first time since we have our current interns and resident here. And so, yeah, so it's fun to be moving back into, okay, now who are we as the full team? So that's really fun.
Nice. That's great.
How about for you? What's a highlight?
I had an opportunity this past week or so to go to a conference in Dallas, and it was put on by the National Collegiate Honors Council. So now with my role as honors director here at Crown College, I've had an opportunity then to go and check this conference out. There's a couple highlights, I think, for me to go into this conference. As you know, like, professional conferences can be interesting, right? Because some of the fun of it is just bumping into people and seeing people.
But this was your first time at this one, yeah?
And that's the problem, yeah. So an interesting thing was, it was my first time at it, and I literally didn't know a single person there. A single person.
Yeah.
And I was saying to somebody else here that when you go to a professional conference in your field, like even if you don't know anybody, you know people because of their books and because you know, their faces and names that you've read. So there's always kind of people to bump into on top of all the folks that you might know just from graduate work or whatnot. But in this case, I didn't know a soul, not a single person. I didn't recognize a name, not even a single name that I saw anywhere. So that was interesting. But a highlight for me was they had a couple of sort of plenary sessions or big sessions that everybody was present at. Mm-hmm. And one of them was of an author, a first time author who wrote a memoir. His name is Brian Broom. His memoir is called Punch Me Up to the Gods. And man, I tell you, you know, the conference as a whole was a bit of a mixed bag. There's some helpful stuff, some not so helpful stuff. Mm-hmm. But man, his presentation on his work was so inspiring.
And what's the general theme of it?
It's about his life. It's his life story. Cool. And he talks a lot about what it was like just growing up as an African American in a predominantly white, you know, community. And he talks, and I think in Ohio, he talks a lot about some of the difficulties of being gay and how that played into, you know, especially some of the ways he's treated in both white communities and African American communities, and just some of his journey. It's not an easy read. The themes are tough. He's brutally honest, refreshingly brutally honest. Like, I don't know if I've read a work like this where I've experienced someone who's not just honest in a way of just saying what happened, but reflecting on some of the meaning of it and in profound ways. It's very moving work. It's like I said, I mean, there's times where it's hard to read, but that was a highlight for me for sure, is hearing this author present his memoir material, and also having a chance. I got the memoir and had a chance to start reading through it. It's refreshingly brutally honest.
I feel like I have found myself often at conferences where I don't know anybody. I think there's always something so interesting to me about coming in from the outside and trying to figure out, you know, who is this group and what do they care about? And do I fit here or not? You know, those kinds of questions.
Yep.
But then it's always interesting too, like when you find something that you really resonate with, you know, and it's like, oh, I'm going to keep thinking about this, you know, and yeah. Yeah, interesting. That's cool.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah, it was a very practical conference compared to some of the other conferences I go to. I mean, no offense to my own field, and it's sad that I can even say this, but it's true. Sometimes the biblical studies conferences aren't all that practical. I mean, they generate some interesting ideas and interesting thoughts, but this was very practical in that it was all about what people are doing with their honors programs. So like you can leave having heard about other honors programs and really just think about, okay, what do we need to implement? Like, what do we need to do to make this happen? So it was a lot less sort of theoretical. I mean, there's certainly theory behind some of the ideas, but I found that to be quite refreshing.
It reminds me, I used to go to several different kinds of conferences, but one of those was service learning conferences. And I really enjoyed those because it was about the pedagogy.
Yeah.
Right? So
exactly. You know, like,
some of the other ones were more theoretical, like you were saying, but I really enjoyed the pedagogy. You know, how do we do this better? How do we help students to grow and develop in the things that, in these ideas, right? But then to actually make that lived out. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's a low light for you?
I guess maybe I'll attach it to that same thought, which is one low light I think would be that it was a bit of a lonely conference. Like, I mean, I was in Dallas and I love the city of Dallas. There's a lot of great spots. There's some wonderful food. I was able to kind of just Uber to the hotel and then walk everywhere.
In the U.S.? There's a place you can walk everywhere?
In the U.S.
Nice.
Well, because of where the conference was located, where my hotel was located and all the spots I needed to go to. Although I missed a gelato spot that I wanted to go to because it would have cost me about $25 round trip just by Uber to get there and back.
Oh,
and
is I'm that like, right? How about that?
Yeah, I don't know if I can justify an expensive a $30 gelato. So it was interesting. Cause I don't know. It got me reflecting. So low light, I mean, it's weird, you know, so I haven't been there. There haven't been many times in my life where I'm like stuck in a hotel room by myself. You know, think about that. I mean, like there's times where I've gone to conferences where I've been in a hotel, you know, by myself before, but I've known people at the conference. I've had stuff to do.
Right.
But like, and I think about this, I don't think I've ever lived by myself.
Oh, interesting.
I don't think I have ever. Yeah. I used to sort of rent, if rent's the right word. The family I lived with was very generous and charging me almost nothing. So I rented a room out from a family in their house. I mean, but it was their house. They were there and there was people around. Then I got married. I lived with my in-laws with my wife. And then we moved into our house and I was in college, you know, and then I moved in with some roommates. And so I don't think I've ever lived by myself. So even just being kind of in a space by yourself for three or four days feels weird.
Feels weird.
So I don't know. There's something kind of, I don't know, kind of lonely about it, I guess. It's just wasn't a highlight. And then I kept thinking like the conferences aren't the kind of space that are designed for you to just soak in and go. Like it's bouncing ideas off of people and that's the fun part. And so I had nobody to bounce ideas off of. Like I really felt like, this would probably be a better conference if I had a colleague with me
that I could chew on this with.
So there's a lot about it that I'm like, I mean, the kind of goal of me going was to scope it out, see if it was worthwhile for Crown to be participating in the organization and pay the fees to do it. So I think that was successful. I was able to discern some of that, but not my preference. That's for sure. Just going on a conference and doing it that way. Well, how about for you? It was a low light.
So I think this is maybe redundant from last year, but, so on my phone, I now have the sunset and sunrise showing up on the home screen.
Oh yeah.
Which wasn't really on purpose, but the sunset today was at 4:19. And it doesn't come back up until 7:22. And it's just going to get more intense over the next month and a half years roughly that. So yeah, just the darkness. It's very, very, we're moving into the dark time of year. So I think,
we are,
maybe that's a broken record from last year. I don't know, but,
I get it.
It's interesting though. You just feel it, you know,
Yeah. That's weird. Cause I feel like once snow arrives in Minnesota, it's weird because the nights are less dark.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you get this kind of weird light that comes shining off of the snow.
Yeah.
But we don't have snow right now. So dark is dark. It's really dark.
We get the opposite of that. We hardly get any snow, and then we do get heavy cloud layers. And so it's dark, dark during the day and then darker at night. And this, there's just not a lot for street lights here. It's really interesting. Like parks are not lit. Streets are barely lit. And so it's just when it's dark, it's very dark. Yeah. Even in like, I was walking down by Brandenburg Gate not too long ago, and it was dark, and I was in the part of Tiergarten, which is right there by the gate. And I was like, okay, I'm in a very like populated area, like not it's not residential, but there's a ton of people. I'm like in between the Capitol building and the Brandenburg Gate. And it was just so dark in this park walk. And I was like, it was so different than what I'm used to. Anyway.
Yeah, that is different.
I mean, it was only like, I don't know, 7 p.m. or something. It's not like it was, you know, one in the morning or whatever. Yeah. Anyway.
So what's your insight for the week?
Oh man, I've been trying to wrestle with what my insight is because I've been reading this book. I guess I'll go this direction. I've been reading this book and I think you've seen a couple of posts that I've made about it. And I'm really enjoying it. It's a theological book, and it's been a while since I've read theology, and it's been probably even longer since I've read it for fun. And I am just really enjoying this book. And the author was is a German guy. I believe he's still alive. Yeah.
And Jürgen Moltmann.
That's the guy. Yeah. Has this book called The Theology of Hope. He has several other books in the same similar direction. And I had been looking forward to reading this book for more than a year, and for whatever reason, getting the English version of it was a little difficult here. And so I don't even know. I feel like I'm still at a pre-insight stage. I guess the insights that I've had, I've written in the blog on the Patreon. Yeah. Maybe the insight, I don't know. So today I was reading again, and I got out of the introduction into the first like kind of meaty chapter. And I was like, oh man, okay. Cause the feeling of it changes, right? Like now this is heavy theological work, and it's like, okay, so what, or at least that's the way it feels to me, thinking, okay, so what do I need to, how do I read this well to get what I want out of it? Like, what should I be getting out of it? And so I don't know. I think, okay, here's an insight is that I was paying attention to who I was as a reader as I was reading it. And I was thinking about how, so the way he built his argument, occasionally he'll, consider another idea and develop it for a while before he says, okay, now here's the counter idea to that. And thinking about like taking care as the reader to understand what is the author actually saying. You know, because I think sometimes it's easy to almost agree with the thing that they're putting up as not what they say, and to misinterpret them as saying that thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I feel like it's all over the place as an insight, but something in there. I'm really enjoying reading the book and paying attention to myself as a reader as I go is interesting.
Yeah, that's great. And by the way, if you ever have any issues getting a book, just let me know. I'm serious. I will get, I mean, I can get you books and send them to you. Okay. So
yes, thank you.
so, I mean, if it's $120 or something, you know, that might be a little trickier, but you know, I mean, Moltmann, you can probably find for $20 here. Right. So just let me know. Okay. I can ship it off to you.
I don't know if I would have been ready to read it before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I think, yeah, fascinating.
That's great.
Yeah. How about for you? What's an insight?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking back again on my highlight and thinking now about this book. By the way, I have this terrible, terrible tendency. I mean, I get books frequently and I read books frequently and I finish books very infrequently because I start them, I get halfway through, I get a new book and I do halfway through and I've got so many half read books.
Is that bad?
I mean, I'm missing some good stuff by not finishing it. So
yeah, that's true.
but to be fair, I mean, I think for people who think, oh yeah, us folks in the academic world, you know, we're just able to sit at our desks all day and read. If that were the case, I would be finishing all of these books, but all the books that I'm referring to that I'm not finishing, I'm actually just reading at home. So
yeah,
either in the night or, you know, while I'm laying in bed kind of thing. So chiseling away a little bit here, a little bit there. But this book by Broom that I was talking about, the memoir, here's an insight that I have. I think that was, so there's so many things that I think inspired me about it, which was just frank, brutal honesty. And there's so many things that frustrated me having nothing to do with his content per se, having everything to do with the fact that I rarely have ever read that kind of frank honesty in any Christian writings by Christian authors.
Sure. Yeah.
It made me think a little bit about like, now he gets into some pretty rough details about his life, about what he went through, about his own drug addiction, just what it meant for him. A lot of things that I won't get into. If readers want to read the book, they can. Is there something, I just think about this, is there something because of the fact that in the Christian world, we're all striving to live a certain kind of life? And then does that make it almost impossible for us to talk about the ways that we don't do it well? I mean, we talk about it, but does it make it impossible for us to be brutally honest about when we don't do that well? Like, I don't know. I don't think I got the guts. I wouldn't have the guts to write the way he did. I just wouldn't. And I'm not sure I've read many Christian authors that have had that kind of level of brutal honesty. Because I think what struck me so, that was so insightful about what he's doing, is his capacity to acknowledge things that he's done that he's deeply ashamed of, but to reflect back on it. Like, it's, I don't know, it's very interesting. Like, he even told a story, you know, at the conference about a time that he did something. And by the way, when I'm talking about things he was ashamed of, they're not necessarily always just things that we would typically constitute as shameful. They're things that are part of his identity that he looks back and that he dislikes about himself. You know, and I'm like, I don't even really think that we talk about those kinds of things either.
Right.
You know, and there's a certain sense in Christian circles, right, where it's like, well, we don't want to boast. We don't want to, about our things we've done or ways we've completely missed the mark. But I think we go in the other direction where we almost feel like
there's the risk though sometimes of like, or we're afraid of like glorifying the sin or something. Is that kind of the sentiment you're talking about?
Yeah. But I think the risk in the other direction is that we perpetuate this idea that the life that we want to strive to live as followers of Jesus is somehow the life we're actually living. and I don't want to be dismissive. There may be some saints out there who are really doing it pretty perfectly, but for the rest of us who are ragamuffins on this journey of faith, I don't know. I just feel like, and I don't have the guts to write that kind of stuff. Or I don't have the guts to even reflect on things that I'm so far removed from that were things that happened 20 years ago. I wouldn't have the guts to even write about that. I don't know. It just makes me think about that. Why? What is it about Christian faith or Christian? I mean, it's probably not just faith. It's probably the Christian communities that I roll in that make that kind of writing ill-advised and that kind of brutal honesty very unlikely.
Do you feel like? Like, is that primarily a deficit in theology or a deficit in discipleship, right? Is it the practical theology or is it something actually in the way that we live community? Like, where would you look first as a source of the problem?
That's a great question. How would you answer your own question? Maybe I'll better be able to answer. I think my gut says all the above, but I don't know. What do you think?
I responded to Justin's question and we ended up having a long discussion about brutal honesty and discipleship. It's available on Patreon. There are already more than 150 bonus audio clips, blog posts, and more for our subscribers there.
I mean, I don't know. I think there's some interesting reflection nuggets here for people that they might find it useful to to hear us musing on.
Your subscription helps us to produce the podcast, and there's membership available for as little as $5 a month. We'll be back in a moment with Jonathan Benson. I do want to apologize for some anomalies in the audio files. We experienced a power outage in the middle of recording and had to piece together some of the conversation. I think it turned out all right, but some of the sound quality is less than what we usually try to achieve. So I'm really excited to have with us today Jonathan Benson, who I used to work with at Crown and who Justin still does work with. Jonathan is a photographer, filmmaker, and assistant professor at Crown College. He has a Master's of Theological Studies from Bethel University and a Master's of Fine Arts in Film and TV Production from Asbury University. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm super excited to be with you guys.
And I'm sure there's questions we could ask you all day because, you know, we've been talking about some of the things that we're going to cover on the podcast today for quite some time. But we'll start maybe with the most important question. Mm-hmm. I see you're drinking coffee this morning. So what coffee are you drinking? And then every now and then we like to ask our guests, what's the best cup of coffee you ever had?
Oh gosh. I'm currently drinking Daybreak, which is from our coffee shop here at Crown. I'm drinking that. And I, you know, in terms of like how I take my coffee, this is maybe like more information than you want, but I either do like drip, just straight up drip, or I do like a mocha. It's like either one or the other. That I tend to do. The best like cup of like drip coffee I think they've ever had would be from.
I don't know if that's a sentence I've heard before. Sorry, go ahead.
The best cup of drip coffee? I think the best cup of drip that I've gotten would probably be from Bachelor Farmer Cafe. Yeah. So the restaurant doesn't really exist anymore, but they were downtown in the North Loop and I used to work right across the street from them. And so I'd be over there, you know, every day. And it was so like perfect. And it was like the perfect amount of like acidity and wasn't like crazy bitter. They're light roast. And it was just, oh man, it was so flavorful. Yeah. Yeah. So nice. And then I would say I also really like Fragments Coffee. They're also in the North Loop, but they actually just opened up a location in Eden Prairie as well. But I think they're only open during the weekdays. So maybe that's more information that you guys are wanting for your for your coffee.
Oh, that's good. So is the mocha like a comfort drink for you or?
So yeah. I mean, like as much as I do love like just a plain like cup of drip coffee, I do also have a bit of a sweet tooth. And so when I'm wanting something that's like a coffee, but also sweet and just like easy to sip, that's my go-to. That's my go-to. Nice. It's like a mocha. So
what I love about your answer is you went very local. So you went with some Minneapolis coffee spots. So that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. I mean, I've been to like Seattle. There's a place called Storyville there that I really, really like. And they definitely, I might actually say that my best mocha came from there. If I had to think about it, yeah, nice. It probably came from there. So, yeah.
I think one of the things that I've found a little bit sad here in Berlin is it's hard to find a mocha, at least at the places that I've been to. It's like this, when you ask, it's like, it's not on most of the menus. When you ask for it, a lot of times people end up giving you just hot chocolate. And so it's like, I'm sure that there are stores here that have mochas, but I have not found very many of them.
So man, yeah, that'd be hard for me at least. I'd be like, where's my comfort drink?
So can you tell us some about yourself and your relation to our four themes of truth, beauty, goodness, and wisdom?
Yeah. And I love that you guys are doing this through this series. Me and Justin are, of course, having a lot of conversations around this as we work together in the Honors Program. And I'll have the privilege of teaching a beauty class, which is probably why you guys have me on today to talk about it. but it was super interesting to think through like, okay, what has been my experience as I think through these four themes? And for me, I think starting with truth, you know, I came from a pretty positivistic background, so to speak, philosophically. And so I used to think about it very much vis-a-vis those terms and that kind of philosophical framework. I think back to my first semester here at Crown when I took, you know, the critical thinking and writing class in the Honors Program here at Crown. And we were, you know, taught syllogistic reasoning, which I'm actually very, very, very thankful for. I think it's good to interact with those things and to be aware of those. If we were to honestly just take just even a basic rudimentary understanding of the logical fallacies, I think that could greatly improve our discourse in the world of social media at the very least. I think that could help our world a lot. But I began to kind of broaden that. And I'll get to that, I think, shortly when we start talking about some of those other themes. But yeah, I do think, and I still hold, and again, I don't know how into the weeds we're going to get into, you know, the world of philosophy here, but as a critical realist, I still hold to objective truth and pursue objective truth, but I now kind of see and understand that pursuit through the only way, right, to pursue that objectivity is through our human selves. And so we have to understand how our humanity is sometimes helping, sometimes hurting that pursuit, is how I phrase that. But then going on to beauty, I'll answer this like on a more like personal like level, I guess, and then like a more academic sense. And of course, we're going to talk a lot more about that today. But I was always attracted to the arts, I think. Now, with my upbringing, I had a relatively constricted perspective of the arts, I think, growing up in terms of what that was and what that meant and what my interaction could be with that. I was, you know, only really allowed to listen to Christian music growing up. And so...
I'm curious, how was that defined?
Yeah, basically it was defined as if it comes from CCM, you know, like, okay, if it comes from that general world and that general ballpark, you know, that's Christian, you know, music. So Christian radio, wasn't really allowed to listen to secular radio. However, I did listen to, I eventually just got sick of it. And so I started listening to NPR and started listening to like classical music on there a lot. And that was actually largely my introduction to classical music was that. And then eventually my brother went to college and he started bringing, you know, some of these other artists, many of who were actually Christians, but weren't doing quote unquote Christian music. So people like Sufjan Stevens or even this band called Copeland, that I absolutely fell in love with. And then from there to like towards the end of high school, like I really started to embrace this broader world. I'll never forget when I watched The Royal Tenenbaums for the first time, a movie by Wes Anderson. And that just like blew my mind. Like I'd never seen anything like that before and just fell in love with that form of storytelling that was creative and narrative, but doing it and obviously some very different ways as Wes Anderson does. And then like personally for myself, I started writing poetry. And at the time, to be honest, it was probably like really super poser emo stuff that I was writing. but as I began to write it, I just fell in love with, you know, this avenue of creativity. And from there, I started writing music. Actually, I went from poetry into music and then recording some of my own music. And then I started dabbling in film and created my first film and created, you know, original soundtrack for it too. And then film and photography just kind of took over my life. It tends to be pretty time consuming in regards to what you have to put into it. But yeah, I just kind of went from there in terms of my exposure to the arts and my pursuit of it. So I guess that's like my personal journey of how I, you know, fell in love with the arts in maybe some different ways. I think on a more academic side, you know, I began to see too, again, very concerned with truth growing up and pursuing that. But, you know, it's interesting as we look at the world of media, especially, which tends to be the wheelhouse that I work in, We kind of see in the like commercial advertising worlds towards the latter part of the 20th century, this understanding that, okay, we can state logically in as many advertisements as we want why this product or service is superior. But then they begin to realize like, oh, actually, if we tell stories, that's like way more effective. And so we see this shift in terms of, you know, what kind of advertisements that we begin to see. I think we've seen that a little bit as a society. And I think I myself, as I have come to understand truth and as I understand it, I think one of the biggest and most powerful ways we can encounter truth is actually through aesthetics and through beauty. And in part because it has a way, I think, of engaging our whole selves.
Part of what's so interesting, you know, as you talk about truth and as you talk about beauty, there's a sense of movement in your own life of how you understand those things. And so like expressing your relation to those is kind of, I mean, it's your expressing that through story. So that's really interesting that instead of giving us the propositional truth of what are those things, you know, here's your story of encountering those, which I find really interesting. How would you define beauty today?
Yeah, I thought about this for a long time, and I've been working on this course. I don't think I've ever put so much work into a course as I've been preparing for this honors course. And even after, like, honestly, like days and days of reading and studying that I've been doing, I wrestle with this. So let's call it a working definition, at least for me for now, in terms of what it is and what it looks like. But for me, I'm defining beauty as an aesthetic that creates a response and or makes a claim about the world. So an aesthetic that creates a response and or makes a claim about the world. So I think the aesthetic part is important because, and a follow-up question, right, can be then how do we define aesthetics? Mm-hmm. And we could have an entire conversation about that. But all that to say, I think there is this kind of mysterious, and I'm personally okay with embracing that mystery a little bit, but this mysterious thing in aesthetics that when we see it, we know it, right? Mm-hmm. When we see it, we know it. And that's, I think, part of that visceral response that happens to us when we encounter something beautiful. And then I think too, a lot of times, you know, things that are really beautiful or really, really compelling are creating, making some kind of a claim about the world overall. And that goes back to, I think the importance of theme and created works and the importance of, you know, kind of identifying that to continue those broader definitions.
Could you unpack a little bit for our listeners what you mean by that in terms of the connection between theme and what the claim is being made about the world in a piece of art?
Yeah. So in artworks, well, again, my world tends to be focused, and a lot of my discipline is really focused on storytelling and looking at narrative and storytelling. And theme can be defined a number of ways, but one of the ways that I identify it is by asking the question, what claim is this work making about the world, whether it's making a claim about how it is or how it should be oftentimes. And it's a lot of times doing kind of one or the other, which, you know, especially for academic purposes, helps foster, I think, really rich and deep conversations.
I'm curious, as you're, do you think that, so if beauty is an aesthetic that elicits a response or makes a statement about the world, it sounds like there is intentionality in beauty. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say there's intentionality in beauty, especially in when it's in the hands of an intentional artist. And that's why I have the and or in that definition. I think there are things that we can encounter in our world that, you know, isn't necessarily, you know, done with intentionality, right? That might be beautiful. But yet I think when we do encounter something with intention, I do think that there can be, I think there's a lot of times within that a claim that's being made. Did that answer your question at all? I don't know.
I think there's
circle back to it.
It kind of gets maybe even to some ontological questions, but is everything that is, does everything that is have intention behind it, right? And so that would be something that might ask the question about, you know, so if you encounter natural beauty, is that necessarily an expression of the creator, that kind of thing? Or is there serendipitous beauty that maybe is not necessarily intentional directly?
Yeah, I think we can very easily, right, get kind of like into a kind of a Calvinist Arminianist conversation there for sure. I think a lot of what we encounter is intentionally crafted, but I do believe also in a level of serendipity as well.
Can't that even happen on the level of human creators? So you have somebody who doesn't set out to make something beautiful, but it, so in that sense, there isn't that same, there isn't that same intentionality of somebody saying, all right, I want to say something about the world. And so here's my created work, but they make something or do something without maybe that intense intentionality and it still ends up beautiful. So that's kind of serendipitous, right?
Yeah, 100%. In fact, there's a show on Netflix called Chef's Table. And I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's amazing. And in the first episode, the chef talks about, he's working with one of his chefs that was working under him, and they were preparing the last lemon tart of the evening for dessert. And then the guy drops it and he just starts freaking out and panicking. And then the head chef Massimo looks at him. He's like, wait, look at it. That's beautiful. With like this very thick Italian accent. And then, so he's like, all right, we're going to put this on the plate and we're going to do this to all the lemon tarts in such a way that it just like, it's broken, but beautiful all at the same time. And from then on, that's how they served the dish actually. And it's called, oops, I dropped the lemon tart. So I think there is a level of serendipity that we can encounter. I do believe, theologically speaking, that like God does have foreknowledge of all of these things. But I do think that there is an element of free will. I will hold to that in the midst of all that. And I think God is sovereign. And I tend to, again, this may be a little bit of a rabbit trail here, but I don't live in a lot of existential angst or anxiety over the full sovereignty of God and human will. And I think part of that is actually because of the power of narrative. You know, when in Janine Brown, who is my thesis advisor at Bethel University, she guided, you know, my thesis there. And in her book, The Gospels as Stories, she talks about how the Gospels are inherently created as narratives. And so some of these, you know, supposed dichotomies that we come in contact with on a systematic theological level, when you look at it from the lens of narrative, like the narratives are comfortable with that tension. And I think there's something really, really powerful about narrative. And I agree with her that there's something really powerful about narrative and its ability to hold two things in conversation with each other that look or appear like they're diametrically opposed to one another.
So in a lot of your reflection here on beauty, it sounds to me like you're taking the work that you've done in your MDiv program in theological work.
It was actually at Matt's.
Matt's. Yeah. Hey, right on, brother. Me too. Yeah. That's right. So it sounds like a lot of your reflections on beauty here are taking the work you did in your Master of Arts in Theological Studies, and then also your MFA, your Master of Fine Arts, and you're bringing these together and sort of intersecting them in your work. I'd be curious to know when thinking about beauty, then you've got this working definition of the aesthetic that that does something, elicits a response, and or makes a claim about the world. Do you have some way then that you'd like to categorize beauty theologically? We did mention, you mentioned anthropology before and how it's not just limited to anthropology or human creators. How would you categorize beauty theologically?
Yeah, I love this question. I tend to go to two different places there, I think. I think a theology of creation is really, really rich. And I think that's one of the beautiful themes I think that we see in Genesis, right? Is God as creator. And I would argue actually throughout much of the Bible as well, and looking at God as creator. And there's a number of different ways of looking at that. I've been reading through, I think I have it up here. I've been reading through a book by Jonathan King, I think his name. And it's called The Beauty of the Lord, Theology as Aesthetics. He talks about, you know, the creative work is really almost like a manifestation of who God is, right? And so as we look at the world, right? And that idea is not, of course, like super new. We see that even, you know, in Romans, of course, Justin, as you teach that class, right? If you look at the beginning of Romans, there's some stuff there about, you know, revelation. So I think there's something to be seen there. But I also too, so that's one of the, you know, that's one of the theological categories that I tend to think through is the theology of creation. But for me, Christology is one of the places that I actually go to probably most. And that's for a number of reasons. I think one of the things that, as I've been thinking through this course is, you know, I'm wanting to think through beauty in as many different angles and ways as I can, right? And not just in this ivory tower sense or things that, you know, maybe even, especially in evangelical circles, you know, we've considered classical art, you know, like how does beauty and art speak to the nature of God in many different genres and many different forms? And I think Christ's journey in Christology is such a beautiful intersection between all of that, right? Because the story of Christ is so compelling.
And there's this interesting possibility, because I think Christology seems like a bit of an unusual place to go for categorizing beauty for this reason. We often think of Christology as just sort of the sum of all that Jesus did and was. And that could mean he came and he served and he taught and he died on the cross and he raised from the dead. And then we could maybe find beauty in those moments. But isn't there more potential though? And I think I like where you're going with this, because you talked about a theology of creation, which then you kind of wound back to a theology proper, which is that a theology of creation is also reflecting the creator. So this is what's interesting, I think, about Christology is this potential as a category for beauty, is that if Christ is, according to Colossians 1:15, the image of the invisible God, then we think about the way that God reflects God's self in creation, which of course is through the created world and through creating human beings and animals and trees and everything. But the sort of epitome, or the climactic moment, isn't in creating the Son, but in incarnating the Son. And then it's the best that we have in the history of humanity of a reflection of God in creation is the person of Christ. So I like where you're going there. And I think there's a lot of potential. It's not the first place I think inherently in my gut I would have gone in terms of a theological category, but there's so much potential there. Do you have anything you'd like to kind of add to that?
Yeah. And I think the story of Christ is so compelling, right? And so beautiful. And I think back, sorry, sometimes I talk in circles here and maybe I do this like, one of, Justin and I's mentors, Torsten Moritz a little bit, but I'll bring it back around. But I think one of my professors, Dr. Craig Cook, that I had here at Crown when I was a student, would always say that a theory is only as good as its explanatory power. And as we're looking at beauty to be one of the transcendentals, right? And if we're trying to use this to have conversations about the world and how it is on a really big philosophical level, I think the rubber on a very practical level has to meet the road. And I think looking at the life and journey of Christ is such a beautiful picture of that. And so, you know, as we have conversations about beauty, right? We can't just limit it to like these classical conversations about, oh, classical art is beautiful. And this is all, no, like, what do we do with things like modern art? What do we do things like even genres like horror, which I know Justin likes to dabble in a little bit. you know, how do all those things, you know, come together?
It's Halloween today, by the way. Yeah, our listeners, right. Now this isn't going to be released on Halloween, but it's a very relevant conversation in light of the fact that we're recording on Halloween.
Especially, I'm just thinking like the aesthetic that elicits a response that's really so broad, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if we're going to have a definition of beauty that and you know, is able to actually bring into its fold, you know, any kind of work of art into the conversation, we have to be able to look at so many different things in order for it to work. And I think that's why the life of Christ is so powerful. And one of my favorite books on this subject is a book called The Poetics of Evil by a guy named Philip Tallon. And he looks and takes a deep dive into horror, actually, and actually correlates, you know, the Christological journey on the cross, right? The crucifixion, and looks at how we're able to actually look at truth so powerfully through that lens and through that aesthetic. And he uses that as a way to navigate theodicy, interestingly enough, right? Which is is one of the biggest philosophical challenges that we have in Christianity. And so, yeah, so that's why, again, I love that beauty is a way for us as Christians kind of have these conversations and address things that are actually sometimes the biggest challenges to our faith.
So it also sounds like in and of itself, beauty and I'm not going in a straight line either, I guess, but beauty is not inherently good. Is that true? So like goodness is a different category and beauty is its own, and you're looking at that, but you could have an aesthetic that elicits a response and perhaps even an aesthetic that says something about the world that might be true, but without it necessarily being good. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think, I'm going to say these are working definitions and I've been working through some of these things, but I would actually agree that to a degree, something may be beautiful, but not necessarily good. And I think Philip Town, though, defines art as a conversation. Basically, all art is a conversation about truth, either an affirmation or refutation of. And so we might encounter something that's maybe beautiful or a work of art, but we might have some disagreement about that. And I think we can definitely, I think we can encounter something that is beautiful, but maybe is not completely true, right? So I think there's also an ability, right, for something to be beautiful, but then to be twisted in a way as well, in ways, right? So like, so one example of this might be, I cannot think of her name, but there was some might call her a documentarian. I might call her more of a propagandist, but there was a documentarian that did work for the Third Reich, right? That created a very powerful and effective documentary, right? But would we say that work is good? I hope not. Right. Riefenstahl. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Or fully true. So I think, I think we have to, again, we can encounter things that are maybe beautiful in some respect, but does that necessarily mean that it is fully authentically true or good? Not necessarily.
If we want to pull all four into it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a bit of a hang up for me, I think, in thinking about the definition of beauty though, because I like your definition, but that aesthetic is so important, right? Like it's not just anything that elicits a response or makes a claim about the world, because there can be things that elicit a response that aren't beautiful, right? That can be revolting. Yes. Can be so it gets tricky because
that's why the and or there too.
Well, yeah, it seems to, so what about something that elicits a response of revulsion but still makes a claim about the world, but it makes a claim about the world that's untrue and it's revolting? We wouldn't call that beautiful. So it seems to me that the definition of beauty, as you're working with it, has to also connect to a particular kind of response or a particular kind of claim about the world. And this is where my hang up is, because if it's true, right, we can have something that is maybe,
or a particular kind of aesthetic, right?
That might be it. Maybe that's where the hang up is for me, because in some ways I'm thinking we can see something that's visually beautiful, that actually doesn't make a true claim about the world, as you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think, it gets into things like various forms of artwork, right, that aren't making maybe helpful claims about the world. It could even get into things like pornography, right? And the extent to which pornography would be considered beautiful, right, is a whole nother conversation. But there's this interesting line that isn't there about something that could maybe be visually pleasing or visually, it could arouse a certain maybe, what's the, what's, I guess, Yeah. I don't know. Help me define that, right? What kind of response does beauty invoke? Yeah. Does it arouse our desire? Does it arouse and arouse there, I'm using very loosely. Does it arouse our desire? Does it arouse our love? And is that then what makes something beautiful? Because can the crucifixion be beautiful, even though in many ways it's revolting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I appreciate the response there. And part of, I guess, what I'll go to is that, again, there can be an aesthetic that someone finds revolting and another finds beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. So like there's that too. And I think
certainly in music, that maybe an easy place to see that is with music, right? Like,
yeah.
I really enjoy certain forms of hip hop. And when I've shared some of those with students, I know sometimes they found them revolting,
exactly,
whatever it is, but there's personal aesthetic taste.
100%, you know? And so that's why I think when I think about beauty, you know, I think someone might find something beautiful, whereas someone may not. But it's still an aesthetic that's creating a response. Now, to some people, they might find it revolting, and we may have some like disagreements and conversations about the claims that they're making that we may not agree with other people on. But I think this brings into, you know, conversation, right, context and culture too. And I think that's an important thing to bring into the conversation.
So it sounds like part of what you're talking about is there can be something that's aesthetically appealing, but untrue.
Yes.
Or something that's aesthetically unappealing, but true. And of course the reverse of that is true, right? You could be aesthetically appealing and true, or aesthetically unappealing and untrue. But this idea that aesthetic appeal in and of itself does not make something true or good. And I think one of the questions that I have a particular artist's work jumping to mind, and I don't know if I want to throw him under the bus, but I'm thinking of, you know, in Christian art, and I'm thinking of American U.S. evangelical white Christian art, there are certain themes or certain tropes that are really common. And I don't know that they're always the most true, even though they're often visually appealing. Can you help us think about that, kind of the intersection between the aesthetic appeal of something and the truthfulness of it, and particularly in the Christian experience of that?
Yeah. And part of me wants to just leave that question for like its own thing, because it's so its own can of worms. But I would definitely agree with the overall premise of the question, right? Is that something can be visual, like aesthetically appealing, but untrue, right? Or something could be maybe aesthetically repulsive or revolting, but be very true in terms of what it's saying, right? Mm. Yeah. And so I think as we're talking about art, right, I think that's something to keep in mind in terms of the overall conversation about beauty.
And of course, there's also this whole question in the middle of that has to do with the epistemology of art, right? You know, how much of it depends on the response of the observer, and how much of it is kind of this communicated by the author. But that's a whole separate set of questions.
Yeah, it is. It is a whole separate set of questions that I think are so important and so valuable. But yeah, so I think when I encounter something that maybe, there have been so many times, I don't necessarily have a specific example in mind, but there have been so many times when I, you know, see something or see or encounter a work of art that at first glance I may be repulsed by, or like don't necessarily, my first instinct, right, is to not think, oh, that's beautiful. But then when I look at the statement that it's making about the world, I'm like, oh, wow, that's profound or beautiful, you know? So I think, I think there's a lot of room for that in particular.
In our next episode, Justin asks Professor Vinson whether Christian filmmaking suffers from trying too hard at the expense of the art itself. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.
All right. Hey, have a good one here.
Cool. Yeah, you too.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bye.